better.
April 14th, 2015, 2010.
And this is Char Tortorici interviewing Bob Miller.
Okay.
Okay, sounds good. Bob, before we get started talking about academic staff and governance, can you tell us a little bit about your background in school and where and why you attended the institutions you did?
I started here in 1954 in electrical engineering.
When you say here, UW-Madison?
UW-Madison in electrical engineering. And then I got drafted and spent 2 years in the Army, got out, worked 2 years, got married, and then decided to come back to school in January of 59. And I didn't want to go into second semester chemistry or second semester calculus or after
a
four-year layoff.
Got it.
Almost 5 years. So I picked a philosophy major at first, and then I ended up gravitating toward radio and television. And from there I moved into the School of Education, got certified to teach public speaking, theater.
From philosophy?
Well, I switched to a comm arts major.
Oh, comm arts, okay.
And a minor in English. Finished one course short of a philosophy major.
Okay.
Descartes through Kant.
Ah, one through everything.
And then after I got my bachelor's degree, I taught high school English up in Kewaunee, Wisconsin for a year. And I decided I was spending 60 hours a week to do what I thought wasn't a good enough job. Although I had checked, and in the previous 5 years before I taught there, a total of 9 students who graduated from Kewaunee High School had come to Madison to school in 5 years. 46 kids out of my senior class came here.
Oh my gosh.
So I figured I must have had some influence on them.
That's amazing.
Some of them went to a two-year center and then transferred, but I was amazed.
Yeah, what a difference.
So then I spent the summer looking for a job, and nobody wanted to hire anyone in the summer who was a teacher, because they thought you just want a good job with some good money and then you're going to quit and go back to teaching in the fall. So I ended up taking civil service tests and got a position as a admissions person, registrar person in the registrar's office at UW-Milwaukee.
Okay.
And then...
That was covered under civil service
right,
policies
and
procedures.
Right, I was admissions counselor one or something was the civil service title. And then I had a chance to come here in the admissions office as an academic staff position. And I jumped at that because I wanted to go back to grad school.
Okay.
So I got a master's degree in educational policy studies.
Here at Madison.
Yeah, mostly on, most of my courses were philosophy of education courses.
There you go, you did combine that.
Right.
So did you work full-time while you were getting a master's degree?
I worked full-time as an undergrad.
Oh,
except for the semester I student taught.
Okay.
But I finished school with no debt. Which you can't do today.
Right.
I mean, I could make enough in the summer. I loaded trucks at Gardner Bakery at night, and I could make enough in the summer to pay room and board, tuition, books, and have some spending money left over in one summer.
Wow.
You can't do that anymore.
I
could make $1,500, $1,600 in the summer, and tuition was $110. So.
When you were working on your master's degree,
mm-hmm.
were the classes at night so you could do work during the day, or
yes,
really?
I was.
The department had night classes even back then.
Right, and I think I once took one course during my lunch hour, so that worked too. That's the only one I think I took during the day.
You said had policy studies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they were kind of ahead of their time.
Yes.
In terms of evening
yes.
classes.
Yes, and I think I was the first person to get a master's, because almost everyone in their department bypasses the master's and just continues for a PhD program. When they get their PhD, they also give them a master's.
Oh, interesting.
And I wanted
okay.
to quit at that point because I didn't know that I wanted to get a PhD in that department. And after working for a while in the admissions office and then as an assistant dean in School of Education, I decided I'd do PhD work in educational administration, the administration of student services in higher ed, which I did. I got to the point where I had finished all my coursework and discovered that you were not allowed to work full-time and go to graduate school full-time.
The 150% rule.
Right. I was taking like 6 credits a semester, and I thought, that's an unfair rule, that I ought to challenge it on discrimination, because the only people they ever caught were people who worked for the university. They run a list of grad school employees and a list of students.
Yes.
And compare them. I could have worked at Oscar Mayer's 80 hours a week, and
indeed,
unless somebody called them and told them.
Or in your case with Ed Admin, the principal that's full-time at a local
right,
high school
right.
could be doing this.
So I didn't think that was fair. So instead of writing my dissertation, which I did chapter one, but by the time I was ready to finish it, I decided I no longer needed one because I was no longer in awe of anybody who had one.
<There you go. laughs>
But I spent 3 years working with administrators and mostly Regent de Bartoleben mm-hmm. on the Board of Regents, who's my favorite regent of all time. I had talked with him off and on when I was at regent meetings. They'd take breaks once in a while, and I'd talk to him several times and happened to know that he worked full-time while going to law school here.
Very interesting, but he did yeah. not work on campus, so they never made the match?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, took 3 years, but I got the rule changed. The grad school can no longer require that unless they're the employer. If they're the employer of a grad student, they can tell you, if you're going to work for me, I don't want your work and school to ever be more than 150%.
Right. That's the sign-off now.
Right.
Your supervisor has the right to say no. But as a dissertator, that's considered full-time graduate
mm-hmm.
school. So
even though you're only taking 2 credits.
Right.
And you've probably been working on the dissertation for 6 years, as it was, doing various kinds of research to narrow your subjects right. down. So I figured the 3 years I spent getting that rule changed was as worthwhile to me as getting a PhD.
Now that was somewhat later.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the rule change.
That was in the 70s.
Okay.
And several friends of mine were able to finish their graduate school program without having to go half time at work.
And several friends of yours did it under the wire,
mm-hmm.
and no one heard about it.
Right.
People turned the other way. Several people that are being interviewed for this
yes.
particular project.
I know a couple of them.
So you had your thesis topic picked?
Mm-hmm.
What was it?
My thesis topic was to have 3 groups of students coming in as freshmen. One group you did nothing with. Another group, you sent them 1 or 2 letters a semester in my office in Education Student Services, and inviting them to come in if they wished, even though they might not be in education. They might be pre-secondary, pre-elementary, which is in LNS.
Mm-hmm.
And a third group where we called everybody in once a semester. And then my goal was to do a survey then, listing all the various student services available on campus, and finding out in the survey which services the students had used and which ones they found most valuable, and then compare the ones we had talked to with the ones who got letters and the students who did nothing to see what differences mm-hmm. might show up.
My bet is you've got a hunch of how that was going to come out because you lived it every day.
Right. My hunch was that LNS wasn't going to come off real well. The Dean of Students' Office would come off well, and the other colleges, agriculture in particular, I think, and education, would come off well with the students. because after I stopped calling the groups in, I did it for 2 years. I still had students who had no intention of coming into the School of Education, who came every semester for advice from our office, be they in agriculture or LNS or whatever program they were in.
Well, there is a reason, in addition to them liking you. Those of us who were on campus would refer kids to you guys all the time, because I mean, how many kids did I say, just say you're considering education,
right?
Because the advising they were getting elsewhere was just so poor, and we knew that if we could get them in your door,
mm-hmm.
they would at least be on the right track.
One of the best compliments I ever got as a counselor in the School of Education was, there's a scholarship or an award given to returning adult students.
Mm-hmm.
And in their interview, one of the questions they ask when they're interviewing the candidates for this award is, which student services, after coming back to school after being away for a number of years, which student services did you find most valuable, and, you know, which ones did you try using? Which ones did you try using, and which ones of those did you find most valuable? And this one candidate said, the chair of the committee told me later, my first day on campus, I saw Bob Miller in the School of Education, and after that, I didn't need any other services.
Oh, that's amazing. What a great compliment. Yeah. But and that's how a lot of us felt about the advising that went on, and I've been away for a while, but pretty close to my retirement.
Chuck was really good, too.
Yeah.
And some of our graduate students are great.
Yep.
Stephanie Fedor, who I still correspond with down in Alabama, was a grad student in counseling and guidance working in our office.
And you're still in touch with her?
Mm-hmm.
That's terrific.
She went into counseling and guidance because she couldn't decide what she wanted to do with her life, and she came in to see me about it. And I told her to talk to the people in counseling and guidance and the people in vocational rehabilitation in special ed area, because I thought a service-oriented program like that would be a good match with her if she was interested in those fields. And I told her what I tell all students, go and talk to somebody who does what you want to do.
Always good.
Don't ask them how they like their job, because they're not going to tell a stranger that they've hated their job for the last 10 years. Ask them how much time a week or a day do they spend talking with people, how much time on the phone, how much time doing paperwork, and how much time in meetings. You can break that down and decide if you like that mix in a particular occupation, but our views of what people actually do because they have a certain title are so skewed. So she went into guidance and counseling, and I wrote her a nice letter to the state of Alabama and then gave her a counselor's license.
Always good to have a license to practice.
Yes.
Okay. So you started out at the university quite young.
Mm-hmm.
And you started out at Milwaukee.
I started working at Milwaukee.
Right.
Yeah, as a student, I started out 54.
Yeah, and then taught, but then came to UW-Milwaukee, and that was through a civil service process. So
mm-hmm.
that was, you got the highest score and you interviewed well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then how did you transfer to Madison?
That's a little fuzzy to me. I think Dave Vincent called me and asked me if I wanted to work. Oh no, I just sent a general feeler out as to whether they had any openings in the admissions office in Madison. And I got a call from, pretty sure it was Dave Vinson. No, this was before Lee was there. I was there when they hired Lee. Leola Hayes was sort of acting director of admissions. Her title was officially assistant director of admissions, but the director was, at the time, the person who was registrar and director of admissions.
Okay, which is what we have now, sort of.
Oh, really?
In the enrollment services. that covers both the registrar and admissions, although we just hired a new director of admissions, but they report to the enrollment services person.
Oh.
So that's going back to a model that we had previously.
Well, the problem when they decided to split it up into two positions was that the person that was going to be registrar absolutely had to have some computer skills. And the person that was, at the time, registrar and director of admissions, Wayne Kukan, couldn't add up a grocery bill, I don't think. Well, maybe he could. So he chose director of admissions. They gave him his choice. And they brought in a really good computer person for registrar to start with.
Okay. So it was pretty casual. Like, yeah. You got your job. Yes, right. We've got an opening. Come on over. And that was then, were you a specialist?
Yes, I was a specialist.
Okay.
A very common designation among academic staff.
Indeed it was.
Yeah, and then in about 19, it must have been like 66, 67, I scheduled a meeting with Martha Peterson, who was then sort of guru of student services for the campus, and talked to her about the fact that we're losing good academic staff people, that I knew they worried about losing faculty, and they do things about it, but they've done nothing for academic staff, some of whom could be faculty if they, you know, really wanted to be.
Or were at any other campus.
Right. And that we needed to set some sort of organization up where people who felt they had earned a chance to move up in terms of responsibility, but were unable to in the department they were in because there weren't that many academic staff positions, hopefully they could find a way to move parallel, at least, into a department where there was a chance for advancement with their skill set. And she thanked me for coming up, and then I heard 2 days later from some friends of mine that worked in Bascom that she didn't think much of me or my idea.
But that priority referral was eventually put into place.
Yes.
But not then.
Not then.
It was a little later. Huh?
Right. Well, I was the lone wolf on that one. I hadn't worked with anybody else on any ideas about things academic staff could do for reorganization or...
Well, if that was 67, that was way before academic staff woke up,
mm-hmm.
and started thinking about what do we need.
Right, so that when I heard about this group that was getting together to try and do some things that would benefit academic staff, this was at the time system was proposing rules, some of which were disadvantageous to academic staff. So I remember there was 6 or 7 of us that went out to meet with Regent Levine, and Joanne Elder, Karen Carlson, the Scotsman who was in
Alistair McCormick
in ophthalmology, a couple other people whose faces I would recognize but can't recall their names. We met with Regent Levine, and we proposed 4 changes, I think, that would at least leave it open-ended in case academic staff was able to make some inroads into changing the campus rules, that they wouldn't be prevented from doing so by the system rules.
Right, okay.
And one of those ideas was sort of a cloud nine kind of suggestion that we didn't think we'd get. And Regent Levine didn't think that one would fly, but 3 of the 4 main things we proposed he thought should be in there.
And they were?
At the next Regent meeting, he proposed all 3 of them as changes. And the person representing the campus administration, Serena Pondrum, almost had a stroke, I thought, at the time, and postponed the Regents making any decision on this until the next Regents meeting so they could do some homework. But as I recall, we got the changes through. One of them was modified, but two of them went through pretty much the way we had proposed them.
Do you remember what they were?
No.
Do you remember what the Cloud 9 one was?
It was something akin to the protection faculty have and
tenure?
And civil service have in terms of job security.
Yeah, that's sticky.
Yes.
Although there are some policies in terms of indefinite appointments, which at this point aren't being given very often,
right.
And Rolling Horizons, which are being used much, much more now since you've retired, because you don't get a raise, but you might be able to get a 2-year contract or a Rolling Horizons somehow. So.
Yeah, all the good things happened after I retired.
And they're not done.
No.
You know, there's still a lot to be done.
Yeah. Well, when I was secretary of the academic staff, when I had to retire because I was having a terrible problem with headaches, I was taking 18 to 24 Excedrin a day to make it through a day at work. I didn't accomplish half of what I had hoped to accomplish in the secretary of the academic staff's office.
We had a lot of barriers thrown up.
Right.
It wasn't for lack of trying, believe me.
And when the academic staff people, let's see, that MASA was formed not long after we went to Regent Levine's. And
1975.
Okay. I'm not sure what year we proposed the changes to system rules. But
what a smart move to make sure that they were allowing things instead of, those people won't let us do it.
Karen Carlson and Joanne Elder were real workhorses, plus a woman from a librarian whose name I can't.
Heidi Wilde?
Might have been.
Oh, Barb Meyer.
No?
Not Barb.
No.
Jane Bannerman.
I can't think of her name. I'm
trying to think of all the librarians that I still know.
She may be retired by now.
How long were you in admissions in Madison?
6 years.
6 years, and then you went to the School of Ed and were there. How
right. Long? I was 17 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I got a call from the person in charge of the Education Student Services office. It was Assistant Dean Charles Quinn, saying the office needed a full-time assistant, and he had talked to a faculty committee about it and the dean about it, and they agreed. And several faculty came up to him and said they had worked with me in one capacity or another over the last several years and that I would be a good person for the office. So he just called me and offered me the job.
Wow. Okay.
But when he was going to retire, I started working on the first day of registration in the fall when Dean Quinn was home recuperating from a heart attack.
Okay,
so I was in charge to start with, and the dean at that time, Don McCarthy, would call me up and ask me what education's policies were on this, that, or the other thing. I told him the kinds of things that I thought were student supportive, not an affront to the faculty, and would work, and they've been policies ever since.
So you just created policy on the phone?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Got it. All right. That may be why education's known as such a humane place. Very funny.
Yeah, and I had worked with a number of education faculty because I went around to all the schools. I had worked with a law professor to talk about transferring credits from religious colleges, church-owned, run colleges, but courses that were not proselytizing courses. It wasn't a course that all non-Catholics had to take at Edgewood, for example. That, studying the history of the popes is a perfectly legitimate study. And there were a lot of those credits that weren't being allowed to transfer because they were...
Oh, interesting. History of the early church, that
right.
kind of stuff. Wow. Ooh, now they do.
But I went to the School of Education and talked to, you know, a dozen faculty. So they knew me from that experience, and I'd done, you know, several other things.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, you came in admissions, which
is... Yeah, I also did things off the cuff in admissions.
Okay.
When METC was formed, and they set up a college prep program, I was in charge of transfer students at the time in admissions. And there's a process that normally takes 5 to 7 or 8 years to become fully accredited, mm-hmm. and to get other colleges then to accept the credits. Well, President Harrington, I don't know if he was the guest speaker at the opening of the college prep program at METC or not, but he gave a little speech saying how wonderful it was to have another institution where students could try college courses and decide whether they really wanted to go to college or not, that would be a very valuable thing for the community. Well, on the basis of one or two sentences in his speech, I told Norm Mitby that we'd accept all the parallel courses from METC. Whitewater and either Platteville or Eau Claire said, well, if Madison accepts them, we'll accept them.
Ooh, sounds like Eau Claire to
so,
me.
So all of a sudden, they were de facto accredited.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And now their numbers match ours.
Yes.
You know, they've gone and matched all the course numbers.
Yeah.
So there's no question. Very interesting. When you were in admissions, you were in a unit that's all academic staff or classified.
Right.
Education, you've got the full spectrum of every personnel category. Do you see any differences in terms of how much flexibility you had with your work or just climate kinds of things?
A lot of flexibility in the School of Education. Dean Palmer said he wouldn't do some of the things we were doing, and he certainly wouldn't do some of the other things the way we did them. But he got nothing but positive reports from people all over campus, faculty and administrators, on how effective our office was. So that he said, my best thought is to just leave you alone.
Okay. So there really wasn't the faculty-staff rift that some other schools and colleges have? Okay. Was there anything with classified? You know, occasionally you hear the classified...
Classified, unfortunately, gets put down in ways that are totally wrong, as far as I'm concerned. I spoke up at the legislature when they were getting input on academic staff, and I spoke to support what had been proposed for academic staff, and then I added a tail end on my speech that there are a lot of good classified people, bright, capable people who may not have had the chance to finish college or even go, but is 20 years of experience as an administrator in a civil service position equivalent to a 4-year degree and no experience? That the legislature ought to start considering, you need to, you know, thoroughly study the cases, but you ought to be able to transfer some of the best civil service people over to academic staff positions and give them a chance to expand their own careers.
And you can. There is a committee.
Right.
But it's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
I've been successful once. You know, it's very difficult to build that case. Even though the whole civil service route is different now, and they have gone away from degrees totally in all levels of administration and want to see your experience. And, you know, what have you got that proves that you can do this job?
Right.
So they recognize it, but we still don't. They want that baseline. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a mistake in a lot of cases, that if you get enough information on how effective a person is in a classified position where the skills transfer fairly well to some other administrative position that happens to be academic staff, it ought to be easier for that to happen.
It really ought to be.
I know.
The best advice I'm giving classified is redo your resume so it looks like an academic staff resume. Join MASA, join SPA, join, you know, because none of them have preclusions about it. And start acting like an academic staff and use your working title, not your classified title when you say what you do.
Good advice.
Seems to help. But we really do still have those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense? I know you've been retired a while, but what's your sense of academic staff and faculty relations at this point on campus?
I think the actual interaction between good academic staff people and good faculty gives more support to academic staff than if an individual doesn't relate well to faculty or is a chip on their shoulder because they can't become faculty or whatever. That I suspect, my hope was that this would constantly build to the point where faculty saw us as partners rather than helpers.
And do you think that's happened?
I haven't paid a lot of attention since I retired.
I don't know, but
as a matter of fact, when academic staff was moving in the direction of trying to set up a governance system, which is now in place, that was a point in time when my boss announced he was retiring. So,
was that Chuck?
I had, Quinn? Chuck Quinn. I had taken a fair amount of time away from some of the things I was doing in education with my boss's approval. He took over some things that I normally did so that I could be totally involved with a lot of these academic staff issues because he thought they were important too. When he was retiring and I knew I'd be applying for his position, I decided I had to back off from academic staff and pay 100% attention to what I was doing in the School of Education. Turned out to be a waste because they decided to hire someone with less education and less experience than I have to take his place.
Didn't you?
History advisor. No. There were six people on the committee, three of whom I knew I could count on that they'd vote for me, and three of whom I was pretty sure wouldn't. So it was really left up, as far as I could assess the committee, it was left up to John Palmer to make the deciding vote. And
the undergrad advisor in history? Is that who it was?
Yes. But I see that the reason they did that was because they wanted to break down the offices and reorganize them and have person in charge of another office actually be the person that Student Services reported to.
Right. Interesting. So Emily
wasn't it? I would have fought that tooth and nail if they'd put me in Chuck's position.
And I believe that that was fought tooth and nail. But did you work then in that office very long, or did you become secretary of the academic staff shortly thereafter?
I was 17 years in the School of Education, and then...
But when Chuck Quinn retired and someone else came in, is that when you went to the secretary's?
That's when I applied for another job, and a job I was interested in because my previous involvement with academic staff was secretary of the academic staff. And that was the time when they were giving equity adjustments. In that same period, and Dean Palmer told me he couldn't give me my full equity adjustment because that would mean I'd be making more than the new person they just brought in. I would have fought that because it's just not right. But I had applied for the job of secretary of the academic staff, and I could just see the acting chancellor, Bernie Cohen, calling John Palmer, and John Palmer saying, well, you know, he's upset now about his salary.
So So,
it was just tough to work with, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't do anything about it.
And timing was perfect because you were the first secretary of the academic staff.
Correct.
And what was that like? I mean, you had a very well-established secretary of the faculty's office with very, perhaps opinionated is too strong, but I think it's accurate, people in that office.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had this new office that had to create some groundwork.
Well, the first thing I did as secretary was try and develop a really good relationship with the secretary of the faculty. And we got along quite well. Because I felt that was crucial to helping academic staff become more noticed and accepted for things that they recommended, or even just, you know, resolutions that they made for reasons other than, you know, like, well, like when the faculty came up with an award, a scholarship award for students, academic staff needs to join in on things like that, and they did. And I think that helps faculty-academic staff relations, too.
Having those two offices close.
So
were you kind of modeling the secretary of the academic staff a little bit on the faculty's?
Very little bit, because I thought their setup was a little more formal and rigid than I thought ours needed to be.
And ours has evolved, and I think at your hand, where the secretary is an integral part of the academic staff executive committee and very much an executive director type of role that they can play, whereas that is no longer, I believe it was more like that when you first started in the secretary of the faculty's office. I think Sue Finman was very much a part of the university committee and helping them along. It is now a different kind of office, and I really think the secretary of the academic staff has a better handle on it. You know, the other is more support. And I know I'd get an argument from
you probably
the office,
would.
But just from an objective standpoint, I think the model that you established is a better one.
Well, one of the reasons I got that position was a couple academic staff went to bat for me individually with the chancellor, and one of the other candidates was had been an administrator who sort of followed the faculty perspective 100% in her position. And two academic staff felt that choosing her to be the new secretary would be like appointing an administrator in the same way that they initially appointed Serena Pondrum to represent Madison Campus Administration on the academic staff committee that was writing personnel rules for the academic staff. She thought that she was going to be in charge of everything, and people on the committee put a kibosh on that early. And
she's still mad, you know.
But during that process, I think the administration person, which was Serena Pondrum at the time, really got to understand the breadth and depth of academic staff in a way that she had never known before.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought she got really well educated and started seeing why we wanted certain things in the personnel rules and why we didn't want other things, and that we were being reasonable about it. But initially, she didn't know enough about academic staff to see those points of view.
Right, and there was a sense that they were a very flexible, fluid group that were there for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you became secretary of the academic staff, it was clear that these were career positions,
right,
and they were vital. It wasn't the way that originally merger anticipated academic staff being, which was short-term folks that then left. They sort of saw us as postdocs, you know,
right,
that would do something for a while and then move on and become faculty elsewhere.
Yeah, the one thing that we didn't do in setting up our personnel rules was we didn't communicate really well with the other campuses. And there were a couple other campuses who wrote their personnel rules and didn't have anywhere near the job security that we set up in ours.
Oh, I don't think anybody does yet.
Milwaukee might be close because they used to contact us regularly on what we were doing.
But Milwaukee went very heavily with the up and out.
That's right, they did.
And now that indefinites have gone by the wayside, they have suffered. Early years, yes, mm-hmm. They were so far ahead. It was 40% had indefinite appointments,
right.
But now they're not being given. So. They're doing all right, mm-hmm. And with the advent of ASPRO, the lobbying group that's system-wide, there is a lot more exchange. So
that's good.
Yeah. So as the newbie in Bascom, and you're trying to carve out a secretary's
right.
office, what was the reaction from Bernie Cohen and other people in Bascom at the time, Serena? Marianne Udella Smith was around, right?
Oh, yeah, Marianne Udella Smith was quite supportive, and I had worked with her and the Dean of Students. The three of us had to commit a student out to Mendota Mental Health, which is a really heart-wrenching process because the person doesn't think there's anything wrong. And so I worked very closely with her, and with Mary Rouse was the Dean of Students then. You know, I hired Mary Rouse for her first job on campus.
In admissions?
Yeah. We had a letter in the out basket that was going to be mailed to what we thought was the best of a not very strong group of candidates for the position we had open in admissions. Talked to Mary Rouse for an hour and went to the out basket and ripped up the letter.
Okay. And we all know that was a successful hire.
Yes.
Okay.
So the part where all the governance was being organized, choosing districts, choosing the process for having representatives in the Academic Staff Assembly from each of the districts, that's when I was trying to give 110% of my attention to School of Education needs because I had applied for the position that would be in charge of the student personnel.
So you inherited that as a secretary.
Right.
You inherited those processes.
Right.
And those got hammered out pretty quickly.
Right.
After.
Steve Safian probably knows as much as anyone about
right.
that process.
Right.
And Joanne Elder probably knows more about the history of academic staff than, or remembers more perhaps, I should mm-hmm. say, than Steve Myra and I.
Oh,
well,
we've got them too.
But I mean from the early years.
Yeah.
And
we have had a chance to talk. Joanne and Steve Safian's coming up. So, what were some of the issues that you think were the most important for academic staff in terms of the whole governance arena?
Well, even the new chancellor at the time, Donna Shalala, said, you've got to get to a point where people look at your vote on issues that affect the campus, not necessarily affecting academic staff directly, or maybe academic staff are only a small part of the people that are affected by a certain policy or something. You've got to work to get to the point where when you make a decision, it gets put in the paper the same way they put stuff for the Faculty Senate.
Has that happened?
No, not to my knowledge.
No, I don't think we're there yet either.
And I don't know if maybe an investigative committee is necessary to look at ways in which that might be accomplished more readily. My feeling was every time you had a chance to do something that would not get publicity, but that was important enough to get noticed by the faculty and hopefully the one newspaper in Madison.
I do know that when things are brought to ASEC or to the assembly and they're campus-wide things, periodically a high-level administrator, provost,
mm-hmm.
will say, why do you care? What has this got to do with
right.
academic staff? And I think, unfortunately, more often now than previously, the answer is, well, I guess we don't, so we don't have to weigh in on this. Wrong. That's
right.
The wrong,
you know,
answer.
I think you need to weigh in on anything in which you have a perspective, because you're speaking for all the academic staff, and something that upper echelon policy that happens to affect only researchers in physics, as far as the academic staff is concerned, you still make that an important issue because it does affect some academic staff. And
but the other piece is that academic staff are twice as numerous as faculty.
True.
And do have a stake in the university.
Right.
Those campus-wide issues do affect you, even if it's not directly related to your unit or department.
Right.
And trying to broaden that view, I think we're still very myopic, and it's hard to think,
yeah,
gee, we've been around long enough that this shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
We've had governance rights long enough, and we should be very much partners, but
I mean, anything that affects students,
there
are very few faculty who really spend a lot of their time advising students. Usually their advising consists of, here's what you need to complete my major, or the major in this department, and not much beyond that. And I think people in student services, departmental advisors, people in dean's offices, people in the counseling center, they have a real impact on advising the whole student.
Yes.
So any policies at system level that might change things or prevent people from doing things they really feel are important to the student is an issue for academic staff.
I agree. I think also we've lost our sense of where we came from, because
mm-hmm.
it's been pretty good lately.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not sure people realized, you know, what it took to get there.
Right.
So, if you had to think back and say, what am I most proud of? What would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. You mean as Secretary of the Academic Staff?
That too, but in general, what are you most proud of?
From all my work at the university?
Yeah. Answer it two ways.
I think
all your work and academic staff.
Okay. All my work, probably, I really loved working with students in the School of Education. I get up eager to go to work every morning, and they gave me the hardest cases of, you know, belligerent students. Students who were seriously depressed, whatever, I took most of those on, and I think I did adequately with it. A grad student that worked in our office and had two kids in college, one at UW-Madison, asked the counseling center if there was someone there who could talk to her daughter because she was going through a particular personal challenge at the time, and it's hard for a mother sometimes,
sure,
to help a daughter work through some of these things. And the director of counseling said, well, you've got a counselor right there in your office. Said, why didn't he have her come in and talk to me?
Interesting.
Which I thought was a high compliment.
Absolutely.
I didn't know the counseling center knew I existed, except for, you know, times we had Student Personnel Association meetings or luncheons or whatever.
Oh, but there were ties to counseling psych and counseling and guidance, you know.
True.
And I think a lot of respect for that office.
I certainly respected the counseling office. It was a terrific job over there with sometimes really terrible problems that students have in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I first came to campus for the first 5 years, I volunteered at night at the counseling center.
Mm.
And because I had the certification, I got those interesting cases. And I once said, why am I getting these? And they said, because you can withstand a lawsuit. Oh, you've got really? Certification to cover a lawsuit, yeah. Oh, thank you.
They really want me.
Yeah. Yeah. Certified, great.
They so, like me, they really like they me. Was that Judy
like
Garland?
Paper. No, Norma Ray. Sally.
Oh.
They like me. Yeah. So what would you say you're the most proud of as Secretary of the Academic Staff?
I think getting more academic staff interested in the governance process. There are still some districts where the academic staff are so tied into their jobs, and I think like an example is people who do full-time research. They're so wrapped up in the science that they do that they don't have any interest in this stuff outside. As long as I get a decent salary and a raise once in a while, I enjoy the research I do, and that's what I'm interested in.
And the feds pay me, so I'm really...
Right. I'm not even getting paid by the university, so...
An issue that might have come up after you left was it turned out that the federal government said you have to account for 100% of your time if you're on federal money. And 100% of your time does not allow you to be involved in governance. So for a couple of years, none of our researchers would come to the assembly or be involved in governance. And at some point, John Wiley figured out a way to put 2%
John
flexibility.
John has a very interesting mind. Back when I smoked, I had many a cigarette and long conversation with John Wiley outside of basketball.
I would imagine. The 10 o'clock smoke with John.
Right.
Yeah,
so. Yeah, I remember once he told me that when the non-smoking rule went into effect on campus, one day he was so frustrated by, you know, several events that had happened that he had to solve, like, all at once. And they were so frustrating that he opened the windows in his office, declared his office space not part of the university as dean of the graduate school, and lit a cigarette.
Okay. He also had, when he was provost, that little kitchen.
Oh, right.
That tiny little space that is totally dark when the door is closed.
Right.
It took him a while to realize that if he was in there smoking, it gets in the ventilation system.
Ah.
But that was a hideout, too. If no one sees me, it didn't happen.
Yeah. When my assistant up in Bascom didn't, I can't remember if it was a raise or a change in classification I was trying to get for her. The decision-making went all the way up to John Wiley. And I stuck my head in his door one afternoon and said, look, you need to make this change for a very capable and hardworking person. And if you don't, the next time you go to a meeting, I'm going to take all your cigarettes out of your desk.
Ooh, did it happen?
Yeah, she got a raise.
Okay.
But I don't think she got one under Colleen. Yeah, all the secretaries, I think, in Bascom are all, confidential secretary, is that a term?
I believe there's
which
a
has a higher,
and
Colleen wouldn't even consider pursuing that for her.
Hmm. She has retired.
Yes.
I don't know if the new secretary has replaced her, I'm not.
Yeah, I don't know her either. She's from Central Admin.
Right. But I've heard really.
Did she go through the same process of interviewing with the Academic Staff Committee and?
Yes, but in a very interesting piece where I had, this sort of punctuates sleepiness on academic staff part. That was always an ASEC hire.
Hmm.
Always.
Yeah.
They sent a single candidate to the provost, and the provost said yes. This candidates were sent forward, three candidates were sent forward to the provost, or in, was it the provost or the chancellor? Anyway, either the chancellor or the provost picked. And so, what? You know, you guys just gave up one of your major responsibilities.
Right.
And they didn't even know they'd done it. As it turned out, there is some suspicion that the Madison administration wanted someone from system because they do not have solid governance, and that this might be a way to break it down a little bit. In the intervening time, I hear she's done a great job.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And that has actually maybe changed the administration's mind, if that really were part of the issue, and that she's very quick to learn, even though she has no experience in the area. And one of her goals is to try to get academic staff much more readily thought about and taken into account.
Oh, good for her.
So I'm dying to meet her.
Yeah, I was going to go up and stop in the office, and at the time I thought of this, I was going to stop in to see Julie, but she retired, and I didn't find out about it until after she was retired. I was going to take this up there with me and say, what, you only allow 2D art in...
Oh, how beautiful. This walking stick is great. Did you carve this?
Yes.
Oh, I love it. That they would love to display this.
It's a wood called flame red birch from the bottom of Lake Superior.
Now, how many walking sticks do you have?
I know 100.
And how many have you made?
100. No, I probably have 150, and I probably made 125.
Oh, this is just beautiful with the badger and Bascom. They would love it, but I wouldn't part with it.
No.
And I don't think Joan's going to let you part with it either.
No, I wouldn't give it to him. I meant just
to
put
display
on display.
It.
Yeah.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But unless I put it in a case.
No, it'll walk.
Yeah.
It's just too beautiful.
This is the next to last one I made. My jazz cane. It says jazz is on the side with a saxophone and clarinet.
Nice.
Then there's a simulated
very
trumpet
nice
with the bell and actual trumpet keys.
Wow.
And then a leopard skin 9-ball I found on the web so all the cats can join in.
How cute. Well, Bob, you've maintained your spirit and certainly your UW drive. Is there anything you'd like to finish up with the good of the order on the interview?
No, I just think the new people, like you said a few minutes ago, just don't appreciate what a tremendous effort it took to work up to getting governance for academic staff.
Yeah. It didn't come overnight, and it didn't come without a fight. So anyway, well, thank you for your role in it. I remember being on campus not very long and getting a phone call from you saying, I'm on ASC. I've been elected to ASC, but when I step down, and I have to because I'm concentrating on some administrative, you're going to run instead. What? You're going to run.
That's because I always respected you as being an especially capable person.
Well, I ran, and, you know, we kept it together. So,
and anyway, the rest is history.
Thank you for this interview. It was really nice of you to take your time.